I'm a sort of quintessential outsider in the international scene in the Soviet Union. And we have a fantastic line of papers and experts on precisely this topic. The first one is going to be Professor Susan Gross-Solomon, who obviously everyone knows, and is who's going to talk about Soviet public health. She has, as we all know, she's the foremost expert on transnational scientific and medical connections and relations between various kinds of outsiders on the international scene, in particular Soviet Union, into Germany and America. So,
thank you, Anna, for that overly generous introduction. So I sent around a paper, but I'm going to talk to that paper and assume that you've read it. If you haven't, I'll try to make it as clear as possible. The years 1921 to 36 were formative for the new Soviet public health. Its ideology was hammered out, its institutions designed, and structural relations between health professionals, political patrons, and clients were put in place. But for much of that period, and it's around this paradox that I want to work, Soviet public health was accepted unevenly outside Russia. Some players, international and national, engaged with its spokesmen, but others excluded its scientists from exchanges, from programs that awarded fellowship support, and even from meetings. And there are some wonderful moments, and I'm sure Paul has the equivalent for Germany, in which Soviet delegates go to a meeting and find themselves outside the door. So if you look at the interwar documents of public health institutions and agencies with what I call international reach, so I mean the LNHO, the Rockefeller Foundation's International Health Board, and the Milbank Memorial, spokesmen for Soviet public health almost invariably appear as supplicants. And there's a good reason for that in the effort to reclaim the place that they had lost in pre-war international health. Soviet spokesmen pressed every opportunity to be included in international fora and to seek out foreign patrons who would help them to showcase what they were doing at home. But here's the hard point I want to make. The Soviets were not merely supplicants. In the 1920s and 30s, spokesmen for Soviet public health pursued their own international agenda without emphasizing Bolshevism. And often de-emphasizing Bolshevism, and that's the hard point I want to make, they touted the new Soviet medicine with its free, high quality, and universally accessible health care as appropriate for countries outside. This is not an instance of socialist internationalism. Now, some of the most progressive interwar health statesmen, I'm thinking of John Kingsbury, Sir Arthur Newsom, Ludwig Rachmann, Andrea Stampar, and Henry Sigarist, looked at parts, if not the whole, of the Soviet model as a template for the future. And still, for all that, I read the Soviet public health statesmen of the period as suffering from a curious mix of inferiority and superiority that Michael David Fox has described in his book, Showcasing the Great Experiment. So in what case, I asked myself, and I tortured myself with this question, Jessica, in what sense could the Soviets be considered outsiders in international public health in this period? The brief sketch that I've just presented of the standing of Soviet public health vis-a-vis the international suggests that the binary insider-outsider may be too firm, too rigid to allow us the necessary leverage on some important questions that we might want to raise. For example, how did Soviet public health spokesmen manage the relationship with their counterparts, national and international, beyond Russian borders? And that's really the inverse of the question that was treated in the first session. How did they create linkages with researchers and practitioners abroad? And how did they steer the circulation of Soviet ideas and practices in order to reach new audiences? In thinking about the relationship between Soviet public health statesmen and international public health, 1921 to 37, I found myself drawn to, but not entirely captured by, and I hope somebody asked me why not, the sociologist Georg Simmel's concept of the stranger, who is, quote, an element of the group itself, while not being fully part of it. His position is determined by the fact that he doesn't belong to it from the beginning, and he may leave again. The actors in Soviet Public Health who most closely approximated Zimmel's stranger were the representatives, the predstavitely dispatched as early as 1921 by the Commissariat of Public Health's Bureau of Foreign Information, BZI, to capitals in Europe to carry the case for Soviet public health. This is nothing but cultural diplomacy or the use of soft power to advance the image and to tighten relations between Soviet Russia and Europe. For a good decade, I've been writing about the way in which BZI representatives functioned in various settings, international and national, in which they had not been reared. There were successes and there were failures. But I became increasingly persuaded that in the course of plying their craft, the representatives were courting danger, hence the title of the paper, Dangerous Play. With our conference looming, I began to look quite actively for a case that would illustrate the kinds of perils or dangers inherent in the liminal position in which these representatives found themselves, neither insiders or outsiders. And I decided to revisit a case I had encountered before, but whose implications, I will confess absolutely frankly here, I had not fully grasped. So, the paper I sent round revolves around a heated debate in 1935 in the Academy of Medicine over the depopulation in France. The issue of depopulation was one that was on the agenda of many European countries at the time. But there are two interesting features of this debate in France. First, the target was Alexander Nikolaevich Rubakin, Russian-born, trained as a doctor in Paris. For much of the 1920s, Rubakin worked as the BZI representative in Paris. In the early 30s, he's recruited by Rahman as an external expert in the League of Nations Health Organization with the specific charge to include empirical material, statistics on Soviet public health. Then, this is a man for all seasons, in the spring of 1933, he wangles himself a visiting fellowship with the Rockefeller Foundation's International Health Board. Returning to Paris in the spring of 1933 with no fixed job, he writes first on Soviet and then on French public health. So I asked myself, how did this quintessential go-between, poised between Russia and France, become the target of the Academy's discussion? Was he just a convenient whipping boy, or did he actually shape the discourse in the debate? A second interesting feature of the debate was that it tethered or it linked to the discussion of depopulation in France the issue of legalized abortion in Russia. Now, we know that in the 1930s, French pronatalist and family organizations were increasingly linking the question of denatalité, depopulation, and abortion. But how did legalized abortion in Russia get into the mix? And that was one of the questions that got me going. So, in a letter to his friend John Kingsbury at the Milbank Memorial Fund in late May 35, Rubakin explained the attack on him. I quote, and the English is his, not mine, I hasten to admit. My standpoint is completely different from that generally admitted in the demographic science. I am analyzing the health and natality and the mortality from a sociological and economic point of view. And I try to show that the medical struggle has an economic and social limit represented by the social and economic structure. For this reason, I was violently attacked. I have to say that when I first found the letter, of course you find a letter like this, and I was delighted, and I bought Rubakin's version of events. Today, having read both in the Soviet archives, in the French archives, and in Rubakin's own papers, I would be inclined to say that Rubakin was attacked not because of his interdisciplinary focus on demography, but because the socioeconomic stress on health and disease that he was advocating was tightly linked to an agenda for sociopolitical change. Now, when the focus was Russia, that agenda might be tolerable or even interesting. But when the object was France, it was quite another matter. Rubakin wrote to his bosses in Moscow, that social medicine was a hard sell in France. But he may have assumed, and he would have been wrong, that being accepted as the authoritative interpreter of one's country of origin would have favorable spillover effects on one's credibility as an analyst of the host country. Roubaix-Quine's letter to Kingsbury also made no mention of the fact that the debate in the academy tethered the question of abortion in Russia to the issue of depopulation of France. But the record of the debate in the academy's bulletin shows clearly that Roubaix-Quine was caught off balance by that tethering. He had consistently treated the issues as discrete. True to the tenets of Soviet social medicine, he framed abortion, both legal and illegal in Russia, as part of maternity and infancy. And he insisted that the Soviet legalization of abortion in 1920 was undertaken to protect the woman from underground abortions, and importantly, that it had no implications for the birth rate. He analyzed depopulation in relation to the mortality rate. He's not alone here, as Leon and I have often discussed, underscoring the socioeconomic conditions that affected that rate. But interestingly, Roubaix-Quine seems not to have appreciated the fact that the field of demography mapped differently in France from the way it did in Russia. The story that I sent round has its share of thrusts and feints. But I want to focus here on just two aspects. First, the framing of the agenda. If you read the debate in the Academy Bulletin, it would seem that it started with an intervention by Roubaix-Quine in January of 1935 on depopulation. But in fact, Roubaix-Quine said nothing in that intervention that he hadn't said before in his publications on the topic since 1929. And I put all this data into the paper. But as the paper shows, the terms of the debate in the Academy were set in December 1934, outside the Academy walls by Fernand Bovera, then Secretary General of the pro-natalist Alliance pour l'accroissement de la population, Alliance Nationale pour l'accroissement de la population française. Horrified by the projected law to legalize abortion in Russia à la Russe, that was presented in 1932 by the communist deputy, Fressex, to the Chamber of Deputies, Bovera became fixated on the issue of Soviet legalization of abortion. Until 1934, Bovera's articles on the subject all drew only on data in the public domain. But then he got a really lucky break. A colleague showed him a German translation of the proceedings of the 1927 All-Ukrainian Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists that was held in Kiev, at which Russian and Ukrainian OBGYNs criticized the medical sequelae of legalized abortion and, more important, argued that legalized abortion had a deleterious effect on the birth rate. Now, the bit between his teeth, Bovera went to the Conseil Supérieur de la Natalité, of which he was vice president. I can just imagine that conversation. After which, the Minister of Public Health asked the opinion, and that's obviously a formulation, of the Academy on Soviet legalization of abortion as it was presented in Kiev. Now, I was fascinated by the fact that Roubaix-Quine didn't anticipate this push from the outside. Because by 1935, he himself was involved in what we call several different localities or settings, national, institutional, professional, scientific, in each of which ideas circulated. But Roubaix-Quine lacked that wide-angled view of the way in which those localities might be interconnected and the way those ideas might circulate between such localities. The second interesting feature of the debate relates to the data on which the arguments turned. There's a bit of irony in the fact that Roubaix-Quine was hired on by Rahman in 1929 with the specific charge of bringing Soviet public health data to the attention of health specialists. The dust up in the Academy, as I call it, shows that despite his best efforts, he simply couldn't control the data coming out of Russia. In 1927, to be fair, Roubaix-Quine may not have known about the Kiev conference. He was, after all, in Paris, Moreover, the final resolution of that conference in Kiev proclaimed that there were no demographic implications of legalized abortion. But in 1935, when Rubakhin rose in the academy, he'd read Bovarat's article of the previous month, and he knew very well about the German pirated translation of the Kiev conference, and yet he never alludes to it. In his masterwork, L'inégalité humaine devant la mort et la maladie, which was published in 1936, 2 months before the Soviet government criminalized abortion, Rubakhin still endorsed the legalization of abortion and denied any demographic implications of that policy. Now, in fairness, like everybody else, Rubakhin was caught short by the pronatalist turn in Soviet policy. As the French reviewer of L'Inégalité put it, true today, an error tomorrow. But what's interesting to me is that in that book, Rubakhin didn't mention the growing Russian concern from 1932 on about the rising number of abortions in the Soviet countryside, which had always been the safety net for the Russian birth rate. And those concerns about falling birth rate were evident in Soviet journals, in articles in Soviet journals, which I know from looking in Rubakhin's papers that he was reading. So why did that happen? It may be that Rubakhin was trying to filter out for the outside world information coming from Russia. Or it may also be, and this touches our topic here, that as a go-between poised between Russia and France for over 15 years, Rubakhin had simply lost touch with Russian developments. He was, as Subramanian put it, between a rock and a hard place. Do I have a few more minutes? Okay. Finally, I'm going to skip something, but I thought about, and I bothered myself with the following questions. What does this case suggest for the way in which we write a history of international health? And I found myself playing with two thought experiments, which I put at the end of the paper. Could you write the story of the spread of pronatalism and anti-abortion sentiment in France without factoring in the dust-up in the academy at which Rubakhin was the center? Only one of the historians I read, Francoise Thébault, even mentioned Russia. And yet I argue Russia played a critical role in the French story. Bovarat and his colleagues were galvanized by the proposal to legalize abortion in France, and more important, the 1933 German translation of the Kiev proceedings provided Bovarat, the Conseil Supérieur de la Natalité, and even the Academy with what they considered definitive evidence of the demographic effects of legalization. Could you write the story of the 1936 Russian turn to pronatalism without factoring in the French events? David Hoffman, in his chapter on reproductive politics in cultivating the masses, modern state practices, did just that. But I think if you leave out the French interlude, you miss something. The Soviet decree of 1936 on criminalization of abortion did not mention the demographic issue. In 1937, still in Paris, Rubakhin prepared a report for the World Population Congress, and Paul, it's difficult to believe it's the same Congress you're talking about, in which he admitted that there had been a downturn in Soviet natality, but he insisted that legalized abortion wasn't at all related to that downturn. The report, which after all was the face of Soviet demography to the world, makes sense only in the context of the 1935 fracas. Did I make it?
Thank you very much.